When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history, like mold, Frankenstein, and fur. I mean gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
I prefer the first one you had, Simon.
Simon.
Sam, even. Simple Simon, Metapyme. Anyway, we could also do... Should we do that again, Sam Willis?
No, I think that's great. That's fine.
I think that's fine. Or we could do candy, candy corn, candy cane, and syrup, which, of course, is one of my favourite lines from Elf. And I think at this time of year, we should be thinking about doing elves, Sam Willis, as one of our episodes, because I've just been reading the brilliant David Sedaris' book Santaland, the first story of which is all about him being an elf in Macy's department store in the centre of New York at Christmas many, many years ago, and I'd love to research that. It's not as you would think it. Santaland in Macy's department store is not all sweetness and light, so we could dig into the darker side of history. However, this is to digress in a sort of abominable way, because what we should be doing and what we will be doing is following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining very carefully indeed how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam Willis, who knew that the history of jam does in fact have a history, is all about World War II, rationing and the Women's Institute, think jam and Jerusalem. It's also all about 17th century recipes, empire, sugar, colonial trade, and the history of slavery. Or who knew that the history of squid, which is one of our recent episodes, is in fact all about H.G. Wells, the Sea Raiders, and Ladrum Bay in Devon. Walk there if you dare. It's about Archie the giant squid at the Natural History Museum in London. It's about zoological specimens, cataloguing, and the archaeology of knowledge. It's also all about tales of sea monsters from the deep and fossilised ink that is more than 160 million years old. Who knew?
Amazing. I don't think anyone would have guessed that that was going to be what it was actually all about. Let me tell you of my fellow presenter. If history were the firmament, the man would be the central star of the trio that makes up Orion's Belt. He would be the Al Nilam to the Al Nitak and Mintaka, the crucial star buckle holding up the great trousers of the giant Orion, the huntsman of the sky, so respected by Zeus, and without which that great historical giant would be bare buttocked and trouserless. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James the Belt Daybell.
Thank you, Sam. And you may well be wondering who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode. Well, let's just say that if he were a star-related historian, he'd only be the historical equivalent of the Star of Bethlehem, shining his great light, guiding the way to the magi of times past, a beacon to long-distance travellers, ensuring they navigate their way through the deserts of facts, a veritable beacon to all history lovers out there. Yes, you've guessed it. It's the star himself, the truly famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Very good. A beacon, no less.
You are a beacon. I think a star can be a beacon.
Fiery beacon. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected. And today we shall be talking about the history of stars. This is part of our overexcited Christmas themes. This usually happens this time every year. We do all sorts of wonderful, unexpected subjects on Christmas themes. So we've got stars, and we're doing today, and then another one coming up soon. We're doing the history of shepherds, which will be great fun. So stars, James, how did you start thinking about that?
Well, I started thinking about stars from the perspective of stars on top of the Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. And this got me thinking about family heirlooms and memories of Christmas past. Because ever since I were a wee lad, we used to have a Christmas star on top of our Christmas tree. And it was passed on to me when I moved out of home. I think my parents didn't want it anymore. And so it now resides in my own collection of family decorations. And this made me think about those countless families around the world who have these heirloom pieces. They buy maybe a decoration each year, a new decoration or two each year, and they are then at the end of Twelfth Night put away in a box and brought out at the beginning of Advent when they bedeck a tree. And I, in fact, have my own little family box here in my very study with me, and I'm going to open it up and examine all the things that I have in it, because what your family Christmas boxes are is a treasure trove of things past. The first thing that I come across here, Sam, is a singing Christmas pudding fountain, which I bought last year to put in the Christmas pudding, and it didn't work. And I forgot to put it there. Also, I have all sorts of decorations that the girls made. My girls are sort of 10 and 12 now, and I've got all sorts of decorations that they made when they were in nursery school, which I've kept as sort of little memories of when they were small. I've also got, what is this here, a little wooden... It sounds like our show, Sam, when I'm looking through the memory box. But this, I've got here a little wooden postcard from the Wooden Postcard Museum with the Beatrix Potter characters on it. So a lovely scene. I've got a nativity crib. I've got some beautiful decorations that I've collected over the ages and some fake small Christmas trees. Oh, and you know those little Russian dolls that you have? I have here a Father Christmas... and inside Father Christmas is a snowman, and inside the snowman is a robin, and then something else is missing from in the middle. So that got me thinking about the kinds of things that we keep as family Christmas souvenirs and that are passed on from one generation to the other. Not only do I have a star that was on my parents' Christmas tree, but I also have a little angel, a little red angel that I think my parents found was far too tacky to go on their tasteful Christmas tree, and they gave it to me, and my family think it's far too tacky to go on our Christmas tree, and so it stays in its box all year.
There's something really charming about stuff that's passed down through families and things that kind of roll on from one year to the next, isn't it? It's one of the joys of Christmas. And I often forget that I've found a new decoration or made one or whatever it might be. And then I find it again the next year and it reminds me of the previous year. So there's something powerfully historic there, James.
Yes, I thought so. What were you, when you thought about Christmas stars or stars, what were you thinking about?
Obsessed with Orion's belt when I was thinking of you. So then I thought, obviously, about the Star of Bethlehem and what kind of how that allows us to think in all sorts of interesting ways about the past. One of the interesting things about the Star of Bethlehem is if you're a modern scientist looking up or a historian looking up at the sky, trying to work out what the star was that the wise men followed from the east, is actually remarkably difficult, because the first thing you need to bear in mind, of course, is that Christ wasn't necessarily born in December. We actually think that it would be more sensible a time to place the birth in the spring. And one of the real things that gets you thinking about that is the history of shepherds. You've got the shepherds there who are tending their flocks, which is not necessarily something you're going to be doing in the winter, particularly at night. But I will come back to more about that in our forthcoming episode on the history of shepherds. So to work out what star it was that the wise men might have witnessed in the sky. It does obviously mean you have to tackle a more fundamental question at the heart of the Bible about the birth of Jesus and the time it was. I mean, one of the things we certainly know is that the date of Christmas was changed by the Roman Emperor Constantine, who moved the holiday for it to coincide with the shortest night of the year. So there's a bit of a kind of a box of snakes there that is very difficult indeed to unravel. Nonetheless, there have been various explanations about what the Star of Bethlehem is, that it might have been a supernova explosion. But the problem here is actually looking at the sources of how you can find out what was going on in the ancient Middle East. We've got some great 17th century European scholars. Johannes Kepler is one of them, and also some wonderful ancient Chinese sources. And it's amazing how silent the Chinese sources are about the events which may or may not have happened around the time of Christ's birth. And that's a great example there of the supernova explosion. Is it's just there's pretty much silence, or only one possible mention of something happening around about that time. Other suggestions is that it was a comet, and that is supported by people who like the idea of it moving. Another that it was a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. I actually find all this really interesting. I looked into it when I was doing a lot of early Chinese history as well, and it's actually all to do with the way that you can confidently date really important events, the changing of dynasties in particular, by looking at the Chinese astrologers, and they were noting down what was happening in the sky. And because we could work backwards with modern science, we can now pinpoint dates very specifically. One other suggestion is a stationary point of Jupiter, which I quite like this one, because Jupiter's path across the sky is not it's not continuous. It does apparently seem to stop and to hover. So there's a possibility that it was that. There's also a possibility it was a conjunction of Jupiter, Regulus, and Venus to give it some particular brightness. But I, of course, you know, think that these explanations are nonsense. And actually, the way you need to look at it is to consider the fact that what they were looking at is the Death Star from Star Wars. And that led me on to some really, really wonderful work I will talk about in a minute, not right now, about the early history of toys and memorabilia and collectibles linked with films, James. So that's coming your way.
Excellent, excellent. The history of Star Wars. I mean, maybe it's worth a moment just dwelling on this idea, on the Star of Bethlehem and the history behind that, because this is where we get the idea of the from the Nativity story from the Gospel of Matthew. And this is where wise men coming from the east follow a star, travel to Jerusalem, where they meet King Herod of Judea and ask him, you know, where is the baby who's the king of the Jews? And this is in Matthew 1:18 to 2:23. And in our last episode, when we looked at donkeys, I read a rather dreadful version of the Bible, a rather sort of modern, unpoetic version. And I found the authorised King James version here, which is slightly better. And I just want to read you a little extract of this, just so that you get the sort of the reason why we're actually looking at stars. Now, the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise when, as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with the child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being just a man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou art son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for which that which is conceived is in her is of the Holy Ghost. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. Then Joseph, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord had bidden, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Jesus. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go and search diligently for the young child, and when ye have found him, bring me word again, that I may come and worship him also. When they had heard the king, they departed, and lo, the star, which they saw in the east, went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed into their own country another way. And so it goes on. So that is really the sort of founding text for the importance of the star, and it's led to all sorts of representations in literature and also in paintings, in art. The adoration of the Magi, basically the nativity of Jesus, is represented in art throughout the world, and there are literally dozens of frescoes, paintings, portraits of this from places like the Uffizi in Florence, the Adoration of the Magi by Dürer, or Leonardo's painting also in the Uffizi. The Uffizi has tons of these. There are also paintings in the Rijksmuseum, King's College Chapel, Cambridge, Royal Museum of Fine Arts in Amsterdam, Museo del Prado in Madrid, the National Gallery in London, and I could go on and on and on with that. So there we are, Sam, a little bit of biblical history and history of art.
Yeah, love it. So I was wanting to carry on with my observation that people were not following the any kind of supernova or comet, but it might well have been the Death Star in Star Wars, because the Death Star has a very interesting role in the history of adaption, which is the adaption of a narrative form from one medium to another. So you've got novels to films, or films into TV or video games or whatever it might be, but you get some examples just like Star Wars, where you've got a narrative set in an imaginary world, and they often find themselves adapted not only into a different other media, but also into toys and playsets. And the Death Star has a really interesting role to play in the history of Lego in particular, that takes us to the wonderful world of toys in the early 20th century. And I actually wonder whether the when we talk about shepherds coming up soon, James, that shepherds and miniature figures, I might explore that, actually, in the history of shepherds, the miniaturisation of the nativity. Anyway, Lego bursts onto the scene in 1949. It's so much more versatile, so much more easy to work with than a lot of the others that were on the market. You've got Meccano 1908, you've got A.C. Gilbert's Erector set of 1913, the Tinker Toy Construction set of 1914, and my favourite one, Lincoln Logs of 1916, which were all great fun, but they were very limited. But Lego comes on and absolutely changes everything. Now, as I said, you can put this into a much broader history of miniatures and toys. There's some wonderful examples of Egyptian miniatures found in Egyptian tombs going back to 2000 BC, so 4,000 years. What's really important about the way everything changes is that there's a real focus in the late 50s of particular sets of toys. So you've got the Western Ranch set of 1951, Cowboy and Indian Camp 1953, The Arctic Explorer playset, 1958. There's a Civil War one, Fort Apache. Another Fort Dearborn, 1952. Roy Rogers comes along, 1952. And then it all changes, and they start to get linked to the rights of major films, major media. And some of the earlier ones are Planet of the Apes, Marvel Comics, DC Comics, and Star Trek. There's even a Wizard of Oz of Oz set, which I think's wonderful. I'd really like to have seen that one. Anyway, Star Wars, 1977, and Kenner Products buy the license to make figures and action figures and toys and memorabilia associated with the film. And there are so many different ones. The Droid Factory of 79, the Cantina Adventure Set of 78, and then particularly their very successful Death Star PlayStation of 1978. Now, this wasn't Lego, but then Lego comes along and they start to... they do it immediately, actually. They have to. There's an internal row that they don't want to sell Lego sets that have the word wars in them. But they do start making them. And then they've become Lego's most successful construction set of all. And out of all of them, the Death Star is the most successful one of them all. To do it, they had to do a bit of research into the Death Star itself. And they worked out by looking at all sorts of ways of analysing the visuals that it has 84...
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Internal levels, each composed of 357 sub-levels, for a total of 29,988 levels. And the diameters of the first and second Death Stars are, according to official figures, 160 kilometres and 900 kilometres wide. So they had a bit of trouble with the scale, but Lego managed to sort it out, and it meant that the Lego Death Star is one of the most successful Lego sets that's ever been sold, James.
Oh, Sam Willis. And was it really the Death Star that they were following to the baby Jesus?
I think it might have been.
Oh, goodness
me. Fact that no one else can
historical
really pinpoint it.
Sounds historically intriguing. At least. Anyway, I want to pick up on the idea of the stars and navigation, because what we have there is these wise men, or more precisely, they'd probably been astrologers at the time, following a star. And there is a history of navigation by the stars. And you probably know an awful lot about this because of, you know, working with ships and things, and being able to position oneself by the stars, following the different constellations around the sky. I'm not going to dwell on that because I think, as I said, you probably know far more about using sextants and things like that. Do you know much about that, Sam?
I knew a fair bit about it.
A fair bit about it. Maybe you could chip in a little later on that. But what I wanted to talk about was, I'd been reading a brilliant book. I may buy you this this year. It's by a historian called A. Roger Eckert, And it's called At Day's Close, A History of Nighttime. And I was recommended this by a friend of mine during the year, and I bought it. And I've just been dipping into it for what it said on Stars, because there's been a really interesting history of how people have navigated around at night by stars. And there are all sorts of things that you can do with stars. You can tell the time, you can be guided by them, and you can also predict the weather. And this is a fascinating book that looks at, from the medieval to the modern, a history of nighttime. And one of the intriguing questions is about how we find ourselves in a darkened world and how you get around and how you live your life. And certainly when you're thinking about wandering around at night, you can often be, in a time before street lamps, you can often see your way because of the moon or because of the stars. I remember years ago when I first moved back to Devon from the United States, this must be about 17, 18 years ago now, and I'd come back and we were living in a little village in the South Hams in Devon, and my supervisor, my PhD supervisor, came to visit, and he'd taken my wife and I out to dinner, and then he announced that he was a big fan of night walking. "Do you enjoy night walking, James?" And I said, "Well, I've never done it. We should go on a night walk." This was about 11 o'clock, and he insisted that we go and just wander through the lanes and through the woods and fields in the middle of deepest, darkest Devon, when it was pitch black. He said, "Don't worry, it's perfectly fine. As soon as your eyes get used to it, you're able to see." And lo and behold, we were wandering up until sort of 1 o'clock in the morning and were being able to see because our eyes had adjusted to the light because there were stars out in the sky. And it was amazing. If you put on a torch or a lamp, you couldn't see as far in front of you as if you'd actually were walking with just your natural eyes. One terrifying thing that happened, though, as we were coming out of a field full of animals, we walked over some barbed wire and into a very narrow lane, which was covered by trees, and an owl just sort of swooped into the passageway, utterly terrified us. But there's a history of people wandering around at night guided by either the moon or guided by the stars. And I'll read a quote from the book here. People being guided by the moon. "Many cities and towns that had once required pedestrians to carry lanterns or torches no longer did so by the 17th century. And there are examples of Londoners travelling around by what is titled a brave moonshine, as the diarist Samuel Pepys recorded it. Jonathan Swift related a coach ride to the Lord Treasurer's home and described it, "The moon shone and so we were not in much danger of overturning." And there's another account here that relating to the natural light of the stars, whose glow, though fainter, was more reliable. "It was neither dark nor light. It was a starlit night," observed a man in 1742. And in some parts of England, the first star after sunset, Vesper, actually the planet of Venus, was called the Shepherd's Lamp because of its bright glow above the western horizon. "The Shepherd's Lamp, which even children know," was penned by John Clare in the early 19th century. So you've got all sorts of people who are wandering around by starlight. The poet Robert Herrick wrote, "Let not the dark thee cumber, what though the moon does slumber, the stars of night will lend thee their light." And a Londoner from the mid-18th century recounted, "Between 11 and 12, it being a fine starlight night, I put my sword and cane under my arm and walked." And there are also people, you know, talking about the Milky Way, for example, and the bright swathe of white light that stretched from one horizon to the other, dividing the sky in two, as described by a writer in the Universal Magazine of Knowledge and Pleasure in 1753. "The region seems to be all on a blaze with their blended rays." But it's not just it's not just navigating by the stars, navigating and finding your way around being lit by the stars. It's also that people were able to tell the time because of the stars, where the stars were in the sky. And think of this as the 17th century. This is a time when people might have been able to afford clocks or other timepieces, but also they were able to have a look at natural transitions, marked some intervals, such as roosters moving around in their habitats, or what is known as the roosters were known as the peasant's clock. But also for other people, nocturnal times such as midnight, people would often depend on the stars and moon. For example, in the play Rhodon and Iris in 1631, a shepherd, Acanthus, replies that it is the 11th hour, for Orion hath advanced very high. And also writing in 1786, a writer in Boston wrote, "The poor peasant who never saw a watch will tell the time to a fraction by the rising and setting of the moon and some particular stars." And also, stars would help with forecasting the weather, everything from thunderstorms to frosts. The authors of Maison Rustique in 1616 explained that a good farmer, although he need not be bookwise, must have knowledge of the foretelling rain, wind, fair weather, and all alterations of the seasons. And various omens existed for this, but people also seem to have put their faith in the night sky. And listen to this declaration from a London author of a prognostication everlasting, published in 1605. "Behold the stars, whose magnitude you know best, if they appear of much light, in bigness great, more blazing than they are commonly, it betokeneth great wind or moisture in that part they show." And I just want to end with one really great example of knowledge of the stars. And this is an ancient Chinese star map that was discovered in the 19th century. And you may have heard of this, Sam, because it's on the route of the Silk Road, which, as we all know, connects the West to China. And it's some caves, the Magao Caves, which honeycomb the Mingxia Hill. And they're about 25 kilometres southeast of Dunhuang, a desert town in the Gansu province. And they were excavated between the 4th and 14th centuries. And the caves were Buddhist shrines and temples where travellers would have stopped off on their journeys and prayed for success. And in 1900, a priest called Wang Yanlu, who was a Taoist priest, basically discovered 40,000 manuscripts in cave number 17. He stumbles upon a completely hidden library, and suddenly you've got one of the greatest archaeological manuscript finds of ancient China. And these manuscripts, all 40,000 of them, range across all sorts of subjects, from religion, history, art, literature, medicine, economics. This is basically a treasure trove of documents that had been sealed in this cave since the 11th century, and in the turn of the 20th century had come to light. And among them was an amazing star chart, an exquisite star chart. And it was a 4 meter long paper roll. And in 1907, it and about 7,000 other cave manuscripts were picked up by the archaeologist Mark Aurel Steen, who took them along to the British Museum in London. And they date from 649 to 684 AD. And the chart is the oldest extant graphical star atlas in the world. And it's divided into two sections. One shows 26 drawings of differently shaped clouds, with clouds The other shows, section shows 12 star maps, each depicting a 30-degree division of the sky. And in all, and when you see it spread out, and if you go to the British Library website, you can have a look at it because it's among the treasures there. It is utterly astonishing. It is, as I said, about 4 metres long. There are 1,345 stars depicted in 257 constellations, all clearly marked, all clearly named. And this chart may have been used to consult the heavens, to predict earthly events. And if you think about that in the context of imperial China, in ancient China, astronomy is an imperial science. Court astronomers and astrologers created these charts. And it could be that it actually is an important political tool. In other words, emperors were seeking celestial clues for making political decisions, entering into wars and helping them in warfare. And this, what it shows is maybe the importance of divination in the production of these star catalogues. So it's all about, it's not just about navigating by the stars, but it's also about being able to predict the future for the stars. So there we
good
are, Sam.
Stuff. Loved it. Loved it. Yeah. So the Chinese would have definitely used that for political purposes to solidify their position in court or to defend any decision they've made. So on the one hand, yes, it is a map of the stars, but on the other, it is much more interesting, and it's actually a very powerful political tool. So what you got there is it's the stars, it's a symbol of political power, isn't it? So yes, I mean you have knowledge of the stars, but it's knowing what to do with it. And the star as a symbol is a fascinating. There's a history there to it, and I came across a chapter of this where I'd not come across before, and it's called The Gold Star: Mothers and Widows Pilgrimages of 1930 to 1933, and this is all to do with the First World War. And allowing grieving mothers and widows who are American, allowing them the chance to go to Europe and to grieve at the graveside of their sons or husband. It's a wonderful story. And to understand it, you need to realise that there was the military service flag. In America, each mother or husband or wife would be given one if their son or husband signed up. And it's you've got just a red border with a cream background. Then you have the number of stars indicating the number of people from your household who have gone to fight. I'm looking at an example here. There are two blue stars, and that says that the blue stars are soldiers are there, they're fighting, and they're still alive. And if one of them was unfortunate enough to have died, they covered up the blue one with gold, and it became known as the Gold Stars. And so these grieving women, instead of wearing black, wore a gold star patches on their clothes, which I thought was interesting, parallel with the what was going on in Europe, where the Germans were making all the Jews also wear gold stars on their clothes. But here you've got it for a very, very different reason indeed. The widows and the mothers, they campaigned for a long time and eventually won a great victory. The government set aside a huge amount of money, almost $5.5 million. And they set up a meticulously planned pilgrimage. It wasn't just a journey, it was an actual pilgrimage. It was a 27-day trip, rail travel, ocean travel. On the most wonderful line is they could get lodgings, meals, tips were all included. There was provisions for nurses to help with those who were travelling, who were elderly. When they got there, they were given restroom facilities, chairs, flowers, professional photographers to take a portrait at the graveside. They had 10 days were allotted to tour Paris, the battlefields, other points of interest. But they also had 4 days specifically set aside to spend at the cemetery with the grave of their son's son or husband. 6,500 pilgrims eventually made the voyage, 4,000 in the first year in 1930, and the rest subsequent years. And a wonderful little letter here I had mourned the loss of my only child for years and at times was terribly bitter. But when I visited the cemetery at Romagne and saw more than 30,000 crosses in that vast necropolis, I realised that others had suffered as I had and that we must try to comfort each other. So there we are, James, ending with a nice story of comfort and also thoughts about the star as a symbol.
Oh, terrific, Sam. Terrific. There are so many examples of stars as symbols. I mean, we probably don't have time to get into it, but we've talked about how ancient Roman and Greek mythology led to the naming of stars. I mean, this is where Orion's belt comes from. But I found some really interesting South African star myths as well. We'll just share a couple of you relating to Orion, for example. One of these tales is that a girl child of the old people had magical powers so strong that when she looked at a group of fierce lions, they were immediately turned into stars, and the largest of which are now in Orion's belt. There are others that sort of relate to the moon or the sun or and other stars. The Milky Way, for example, is another strong-willed girl who became so angry when her mother wouldn't give her something to eat, this delicious roasted root, that she grabbed it from her mother's hands, threw it and with the ashes into the sky, and where the red and white roots landed, they now glow as red and white stars and are thought to be the Milky Way. So all sorts of cultures and traditions have interpreted the stars in different ways.
Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. Well, guys, thank you very much for listening to our history of stars. We've got the history of shepherds coming up. And do please go back to our back catalogue to check out the other Christmas episodes, not just from this year, but from previous years. We've always done at least, I don't know, 5 or 6 maybe this time of year, and they're all super good fun. If you want to find out more about what's going on, please follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in maritime and naval history and navigating by the stars, do please follow the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And if you'd like to follow me on social media, I'm on at James Dable. The podcast is on at Unexpected Pod. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, so come and befriend us there. We have a website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, and at the moment we are selling signed books specially for Christmas, and orders have been coming in and we are processing those for people. So check that out. We've got a big book, Histories of the Unexpected, and little stocking fillers on World War II. I'm doing the backwards this time. World War II, Tudors, Vikings and Romans. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast and be a patron, pop over to patreon.com, and anything that you can give to support what we're doing to change the way in which people think about the past would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much for listening, guys. See you soon.
Cheers, guys. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.